Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Thoughtful Thursday is the day every week when you and I have the opportunity to meet someone who has a new way of thinking about things, who can add to your store of tools that you use in your daily life. I'm very pleased to be talking to Eric Vance, an award-winning science writer who is based in California and Mexico City and comes to us today from vacation in Mexico City. Eric was raised as a Christian Scientist, and he graduated with honors from the Christian Science School. Why does that matter? Because much of his experience as a Christian Scientist has an impact, has a bearing, perhaps created the pathway for what we will be talking about today, Suggestible You. Eric takes the time to explore the surprising ways our expectations and beliefs can influence our bodily responses to pain, disease, and everyday events. It's actually extraordinary. Eric draws on centuries of research and interviews with leading experts in the field, and he takes us on a fascinating journey from Harvard's research labs to a witch doctor's office in Mexico, to an alternative medical school near Beijing, to your own local pharmacy. I am very pleased and thankful to introduce to you Eric Vance. Pleased because he's here and grateful because he's here and he's on vacation. Eric Vance, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I do appreciate your interrupting your vacation to talk with us. Now, Eric, you, as you probably already know, are an award-winning science writer. Your work has appeared in Harper's Magazine, New York Times, National Geographic. I mean, you've been in the best of the best. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And, you know, I'd like to start with how you grew up, because the way that you grew up has a lot to do, I think, with what you chose to write about this time and the audience's appreciation for what we are discussing. So talk about your growing up years.
Well, I was raised in Christian Science, which is it's an American religion that goes back to the 1800s, and It's a fascinating religion for a lot of reasons, but most people know it because Christian Scientists, by and large, don't go to doctors. So I actually didn't go to a doctor until I was probably about 18 years old. And when I did, actually, I was very unimpressed. It was a lousy visit to the doctor, and it was another couple of years before I went again. I grew up using faith and using my mind and belief in God as my only form of healthcare. And after I left Christian Science, in my 20s and became a scientist and then eventually a science writer. But I was left with a lot of questions about what I had seen when I was a kid. When you grow up in a Christian Science community, you see every week there's stories that are told in the community about healings that people have, and some of them are quite miraculous. And I was sort of left with these questions about, if not that religion, then what was I seeing? And that really led me to start investigating this book and kind of got me hooked on it to the point where I couldn't put it down, and I had to sort of see it through. So I always went back to that. And if you read the book, I go back to it a lot in terms of my grounding and where I come from.
And what you created is entitled Suggestible You: The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. So it's a really interesting title, kind of invite you in. And I think that I am correct in saying this is the first time that I've actually looked at something that was written by someone who admitted to being a scientist, but wrote in such a way that it is just so incredibly readable. I mean, it's really kind of like reading a novel. It's very interesting.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. When you look at the science of these things, you talk to a lot of psychologists, you're looking at research, it's easy to get lost and forget that this is really fundamental to who we are. This is like a very basic human part of the human experience. And so I really tried to write a book that would that would tell that story and remind us that this is sort of human nature, and this is funny sometimes and it's tragic in other times, and it's, you know, it felt like a story that needed to be told in a personable way, in a very real way, that's attached to real people rather than some sort of, you know, scientific text. It just, that felt right to me.
Well, you have done an excellent job of doing that. Let's talk about the way that you learned about healing growing up. So if you had a cold, or if someone had a serious illness, cancer, pneumonia, things that could really threaten their lives, how was that approached as you were growing up?
Well, it's very dependent on the person. Everyone has to find their own sort of version of Christian Science in that community. There are some people, I think in my family, I think in any family, there's a point at which you have to make a choice. You know, if you have a cold, if you have pain or something like that, obviously you deal with it through prayer. But if you there's a point at which everyone, I think, maybe would go to the hospital. And in the beginning of the book, I kind of lay out the point at which my parents came to, where they realized it was just too dangerous. They were about to go to the hospital when I had a kind of an incredible healing. But I think for everyone, it's different. And for some people, you know, it does lead to death. I mean, you know, there you can't get away from the fact that this can, you know, in some faith healing religions, you know, you do end up with people who push it too far. But it's that wasn't really my interest in the book. My interest is more along the lines of the smaller healings. I was interested in how pain, like chronic pain, arthritis, anxiety, irritable bowel syndrome, like all these kinds of things, how these things would be healed on a day-to-day basis, sort of the stuff that seemed much more common. When you talk about, like, cancer disappearing or some of these, like you said, pneumonia, you're talking about sort of the miracle world. But I was interested in how does and that's very hard to understand, but I was interested in the day-to-day miracles. You know, how did those work? And that's really where my path sort of took me on this story.
Well, you talk about expectations and the way in which the brain sort of takes information in and the expectations that are created. In fact, you say expectations is just a system of shortcuts that our brains have developed to get through life without stopping every 5 minutes to figure things out. So on the one hand, the brain is sounding pretty savvy, because you don't want to have to stop and figure stuff out every time. But on the other hand, as you point out, if what you expect is negative, then negative is what you're going to see. It's what you're going to feel. It's what your world
Absolutely.
Will be.
Absolutely. You know, the brain, and you know this, I probably don't have to tell you this, but and your listeners do too, the brain is a big prediction machine. That's what it does. And this is, you know, this goes back to a lot of artificial intelligence research, people who have really thought about what is a brain. And what it is at its heart is a prediction machine. You take things from the past and you apply them to the present in order to sort of predict the future. And it can be small things like, you know, the ground in front of me is hard, or if I drop this ball, it'll hit the ground. Or it can be big things like the hunting and the plains will be good this year. But that's what your brain does. It's what we're really wired to do. So a lot of the world that we experience is sort of related to these predictions, and your brain, once it makes a prediction or an expectation, it doesn't want to be wrong. So it will often tweak what we perceive in order to have the expectation meet reality, and that is essentially what my book is about. It's about those places where the expectation doesn't match with what's happening. So the brain will actually sometimes self-medicate, even drop its own drugs in order to make reality meet its expectation. So it doesn't have to make any changes. I always think of this sort of bureaucrat, you know, filling out paperwork in your brain, and you know, if you get it close enough to what he expected, you know, he has to do less paperwork, so good, and then he moves on without having to change any big any of the ways that he sees the world. And so that's, and in that is a tremendous opportunity for and for some healing in some cases, and other cases negative things. And I have a chapter talking about nocebos, or the negative expectations, and how those can affect your body, because it's not a matter of good or bad. It's just what your body, what your mind expects, and making expectations meet reality.
Well, and you say very early on in the book that our brains have been subtly deceiving us since the dawn of time. So, you know, at first blush, when one looks at that, you know, you kind of want to grab your head and say, oh, no, I don't want my head. I don't want my head.
is that I guess it's a glasses half empty kind of way of thinking
about
it.
I don't want my head deceiving me. You know, I want my head telling me what's real.
I know exactly what you mean, and it is kind of challenging, because you can, and I use a lot of words in the book purposely, like deceive and gullible and stuff like that, because I'm interested in changing the way we see some of these ideas, and so I purposely sort of challenge the reader to think about these things differently. You know, I mean, obviously people who are Christian Scientists would find the idea that they're gullible insulting, but you know, this there's actually a lot of power in it. It's a very interesting. It's a very interesting strategy for, you know, imagine like the cavemen back in the, you know, because animals have placebo responses. There's a lot of stuff gets down to placebos and expectations. These things apply to, you know, all kinds of animals, not just us. But if you imagine our early ancestors, you know, sitting around a fire, well, it would make sense that some of them might have the ability to change their bodies based on what they expect. You know, maybe blow smoke on them and they feel like they've been healed, so they can go out tomorrow and they can hunt that mammoth, you know, without feeling pain or be able to push through some of the challenges that they might have. It makes sense why we would have a mechanism to push through or to change our body in a way that matches with all of the, you know, all of the various demands that we have on our everyday lives, or certainly on their everyday lives. And so when you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, it makes sense. But then when you think about it, step back, you say, oh my God, my brain is lying to me. It's not a very honest brain.
And then we won't even talk about the kind of fields of work you will go into with that awareness, because we're not doing that today. We've been talking about placebos, and you mentioned a word, nocebo. For those who are not quite clear as to what exactly placebo means, and certainly what nocebo means, mm-hmm. talk to us. What's a placebo? Is a Latin word. It's a Latin phrase, as you describe. Uh-huh. Talk about that.
Yes. It means I shall please, and it basically is placebo was coined a lot earlier than the context that we sort of know it in, sort of the medical context, and it was coined in the early 1800s, but it actually goes back much before then. And Avicenna, who's this, you know, brilliant Persian, one of the fathers of medicine, you know, he was struggling with this habit that his patients had of responding to things that weren't exactly real. He couldn't tell where the drug started and where the belief, you know, ended. And then going back to Hippocrates, sort of the, you know, the Greek father of medicine, you know, he was trying to figure out, how you could sort of, you know, what the effect of doing nothing would be on people. So it goes way, way, way back. And it's essentially any time when you feel better. Originally, it was any time you feel better after taking an inert substance, something that doesn't actually make you feel better. It's sort of a self-healing. But what we've learned is, of course, it also happens when you take something that does make you feel better. It happens on top of medicine. It sneaks into all sorts of our daily life. So that's the placebo effect. Nocebo simply takes that term and turns it on its head, and it means I shall harm. And so it, rather than pleasing, it harms, and it's when you expect something bad to happen. And then it does, and your body will respond. And you can think of, you can call it stress, or you can call it sort of, you know, sometimes it can manifest in a lot of dangerous ways. And the easiest way to think about this is, so placebos are often used when we're doing drug trials. And when you take a placebo, what's crazy is that when you're testing a drug, the drug, in order for us to call it a drug and put it on the marketplace, it has to outperform a placebo. And what's amazing is sometimes that can be very difficult. The placebo response can be 50%, you know, in many of these cases. And in smaller trials, 70%. Huge numbers of people responding to nothing at all. Well, what's
it's
interesting is there's also a section that has the side effects. And placebos also have side effects. In these drug trials, And those are nocebos. Those are when you tell someone this may make you nauseous, it may cause you pain, and they take the placebo and it does. So those are the two sides. You know, in any medical trial, you have the placebo side, but you also have a nocebo side, and they call them side effects of the placebo.
And, you know, what's interesting, I mean, there certainly was a time when medical doctors would prescribe medication, where lots of people would prescribe lots of different things and not talk about side effects at all. The fear and the theory being, just as you've described, if I tell you about it, you're suddenly going to get it. Now, with the advent of the internet, whether a doc chooses to describe it or not, people walk in the office and they know about the potential side effects and will often use it as a reason not to accept a medication.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. And I was reading a paper just a couple months ago, and it was a trial that had failed because of a high placebo response. And I was reading through it, and I noticed this one section where they were trying to sort of say, well, this drug is still worth pursuing because it's very promising. And one of the reasons they gave is, well, it has very low side effects. And they, you know, you could sort of see them really trying to push, you know, that this is worth pursuing. And they said the side effects are so low, they're below the placebo arm. So there were more side effects in the placebo arm than there were in the drug arm. And they were trying to sell this as like, you should trust the drug, and this is a great thing to pursue. And I was thinking, wait a minute. Why were there so many nocebo responses in the drug? Like, why do you have more side effects in the placebo arm? That's insane. You know, and sure enough, you had, you know, more headaches, more, you know, some of them were, you know, relatively violent, you know, stomach issues related to the placebo arm. So it's a powerful thing, and it's kind of funny to think about, but it also tells scientists a lot about how the brain works and how the brain connects with the rest of the body. And this isn't, you know, this isn't the one thing I've learned through this is this isn't some abstract idea. This isn't psychology and people who are gullible or stupid. This is chemistry. You can actually see the biochemistry of how these things fit together, and you can see the chemicals involved, that your brain is actively controlling your body, and sometimes in ways that you might not want or anticipate.
Hence, one of your chapters is entitled Meet Your Inner Pharmacist.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. This, I think the easiest way to sort of describe this, and this just blew me away. I mean, this is just crazy when you start to think about it. And when it really hit home was when I went in for an experiment where they were looking at the placebo response, and they hooked me up to a machine that was going to electrocute me for about half an hour.
Was this the
I didn't really fully understand what that meant when I went in, and I learned. And they gave me two shocks. One of them was sort of a pinch. Whenever I saw a green light, I get a little pinch, and whenever I saw a red light, I would get a the kind of shock that would absolutely, you know, blow me away. You know, my foot would twitch. It hurt so much. They went back and forth, green, red, green, red, until, man, when that red one, I saw that red light, man, it was just the absolute worst thing you can imagine. You know, this dread would come over me. And the last round, it felt like they maybe turned up the green one a tiny, tiny bit. And then they went through and they finished it up. And what they came in with, what they told me is, on that last round, we actually gave you the big one every time.
Interesting.
Which means it shocked me to the point where my foot would twitch every time. But I only felt it when they showed me the red light. And every other time, my brain was expecting lower pain. So what it did was it actually dropped in morphine, a morphine-like chemical. It's an endogenous opioid that would bring my pain down to the expected level. So it didn't erase my pain. It brought it down to the point where my brain expected it to be. And that's the classic placebo response. And that's what and it turns out that it's not just opioids. There's also endocannabinoids. There's serotonin. There's a chemical called CCK, which can interrupt sort of pain cycles. And or interrupt placebos, and there's many other chemicals. Dopamine is another big one. There's other chemicals that haven't been discovered yet. All of these things respond to our expectations, and so when you talk about a placebo effect, you're not talking about some sort of someone deluding themselves and then trying to tell the doctor what they want to hear. You're talking about self-medication. You're talking about pharmacological agents that you are self-administering.
It really is pretty extraordinary. Was this the test, the experiment that you did at NIH in Bethesda, Maryland?
Yes, this is at NIH, okay. And the researcher was her name was Luana Coloca, and she's an amazing researcher now at Maryland, and she's really, you know, like so many of these scientists, just gotten hooked on these questions of what's going on when your expectation sort of steps in the way of what we perceive as reality, and she also works in nocebos a lot. And so if there's some, you know, scientists out there, people who like technical papers, I highly recommend her work.
Well, you've got me hooked, but we're going to take a break, though. And when we come back, we're going to continue, folks, with Eric Vance, the author of Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. And he's so excited about his work that he's talking to us from vacation in Mexico. Eric, we'll be right back. About the study that was done with the Parkinson patient at the University of British Columbia in Canada.
Yeah, so you were talking about the ethics of whether or not to tell people about a nocebo, and if you found that conversation interesting, this one will really twist your brain into a noodle. So there was a. I guess I'll start with this patient.
Okay.
His name was Mike, and I talk about him. There's also, along with the book, there's also the cover story of National Geographic for December, that in which I also talk a little bit about Mike and his experience. And he had early onset Parkinson's. He was diagnosed when he was probably 40 years old, 41 maybe, and it was just a devastating thing for anyone to hear, you know, at 40 years old, and they. They said he wouldn't be able to walk in 10 years. You know, he'd be being hand-fed and in a wheelchair. And he didn't. He did a lot better than that, but he didn't. He did struggle, and until he found this test, this company called Serigene, which was working on a new therapy to treat Parkinson's disease, and. It would basically, they drill into your head and inject a chemical called neurotin into the sort of the one of the deepest parts of your brain in order to sort of restart the part of your brain that creates dopamine that's the crucial chronic the chronic loss of dopamine is what causes Parkinson's. So That was the plan. I mean, he was very excited. He got into the study, and but they would also have some people who didn't get the drug, who just got small holes drilled into their head, and then that would be it. And that they were the sham surgery group. So because Parkinson's has such a high placebo response, you have to compare it against a sham. And so some of the patients would get the therapy, and some of them would get the sham. Well, Mike's life just changed after this. Therapy. I mean, he went from having some trouble walking to, you know, and talking and writing to, I kid you not, heliskiing, and, you know, where you take a helicopter up and ski down mountains.
Oh my gosh.
And last summer, I think he was trying to climb Half Dome. And he just, I mean, it just changed his life. And he had, you know, his doctor was just so excited because this was, she felt like they had done it. She felt like they had cured Parkinson's. I mean, this was it. And you know, the by looking at him, she knew that they were on to something. And at the end of the trial, they made the announcement that the trial had failed because the placebo response had been so high that they couldn't prove that that the therapy was effective. And the company actually went out of business or was bought by another business, and the therapy disappeared. And it just crushed the doctor. Kathleen was her name, and she was just crushed by this until she unblinded the study where you figure out who got what. And she found out that Mike had gotten the sham.
Extraordinary.
So
it's mind-boggling.
All that healing, everything that he had had came from inside him. He had never had the surgery. From an ethical perspective, one has to ask himself if they would have told him. I mean, would you have told him if it had been you?
I think I would have. But, you know, the truth is somebody who's willing to go in for head drilling, you got to kind of be gentle about what you say and don't say, it would seem to me, because that's such a level of desperation.
Well, and the other thing it's a level of
expectation.
It's a level of theater,
yeah.
of expectation that's created.
Yeah.
When you tell that, all of medicine is based on storytelling. You know, whether it's real science, whether it's alternative medicine, whether it's witch doctors, from the patient's perspective, it's all storytelling. You're being told a story about what's happening, and drilling into your head and injecting chemicals into your brain. That's a pretty extraordinary tale to tell someone.
Absolutely.
And I tell the story around the country, and people, no one ever says they would have told him. But of course, you have to. It's an ethical issue. You have
right.
to tell them
yeah.
what happened. And Mike is an extraordinary guy. He's a really strong person, and he decided that since this came from his own mind, he would keep it going. That it was up to him to continue this, and it actually empowered him. Whereas I think I might have been absolutely crushed,
yeah.
and might have gone into a spiral. He felt empowered that he had accessed these healing chemicals, and he kept it going. And he's doing great today. I think he's still doing really well. And so. That's an extreme example, but that's what we're talking about. You're talking about, you know, these a few of these triggers can do amazing things in your body.
The idea that one could learn that what they thought was real as the result of a procedure was real as a result of themselves, in and of itself, I mean, that's just huge to wrap your brain around, and that has, as you say, that just has so many implications for so many things.
It does, and it you know, I spent a lot of time just thinking, I mean, just imagining what that would be like and trying to wrap my head around this incredibly complicated thing. And it is the power of expectation, you know, when your brain thinks that something's going to happen and, you know, it goes out of its way to make it happen. Now, what's interesting is was there something about Mike that made him specially tuned to do that? And that's something we haven't answered yet. And I talk about this a little bit in chapter 3, and it's something that people have wondered for many, many years. But it's an interesting question whether or not he was primed for some, you know, either for genetic reasons or some other, maybe he trained himself in some way that allowed him to be able to do that. And that's a question that we're not going to be able to answer. But one of the questions that we can answer that's important around these questions is this doesn't happen with every disease and every condition. There are certain conditions that are more prone to this, and Parkinson's is one of them. It's a very strong example of this. But there are a lot of diseases that don't respond well to placebos, and it's because of, I said again, this is chemical. This is, you know, this is predictable scientific biochemistry that's happening, and so there's some chemicals we have access to and some that we don't. So, for instance, pain, irritable bowel syndrome, anxiety, some kinds of asthma, and autoimmune disorders. These things respond very well to placebos because the chemicals involved are sort of, we have access to them. You look at something like or also depression, anxiety, but you look at something like obsessive compulsive disorder or Alzheimer's disease or a cancerous tumor, these things don't respond well to placebos. So we don't have access. And so if you understand the rules, you understand where you have opportunities, there are these incredible tools, but it also helps you understand when you really need to rely on the doctor and when your own mind won't be able to help you as much.
Now, the other thing that I think about as we're talking about Mike is that, there are times when people have whatever conditions they have and it in some ways it serves a purpose for them, and it may not be conscious and it may not be a positive purpose, but it serves a purpose. So the idea that one could actually within one's own brain heal oneself, it would have to be someone who wasn't so committed to the purpose that the illness serves that they couldn't give it up.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I never thought about that before. I assume you're talking about someone who sort of defines themselves by this.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a really interesting point. A lot of this stuff is unconscious. So
yeah.
That's the one thing is, and this has been tested again and again in laboratories, and you can actually give someone a placebo, tell them it's a placebo, ask them what it was, and they'll say, this is a placebo. Really make sure they know it, and they can take it, and it'll still work for a lot of people. So some of the stuff is unconscious, and you just can't control it. But you're right. I think the rest of it is, it is a part of our own internal expectations and our desires. And one thing that I've learned in my research, and this is where sort of my Christian Science background came into it, is there's a difference between wanting something to happen and believing that it has to or that it already has happened. And in Christian Science, a lot of the healings, the people believe they're already healed. They just can't see it yet. And that the body has no choice to respond to their prayer. And that's different from asking for something or hoping something happens. And in the brain, it certainly is. When you have a strong expectation that something's going to happen or that already has happened, in Mike's case or in Christian Science's case, it's different. And I think in order to get to that place for anyone, if you didn't want it to happen, it would be hard to get yourself in the position where thinking that it already had, unless someone tricked you. And even then, it's not clear who will do this and who won't. So it's a really interesting point, but it would be hard to access, in my experience, everything I understand, if you don't really want this, it's hard to tap into it. Now, of course, and of course, nocebos are different. You don't want to feel pain, but you do, but those are triggered by fear. And fear is a very, very powerful thing in the brain. We are hardwired for fear. And it looks like, as of now, that nocebos are probably in many ways more powerful than placebos. They're easier to create, and they can last longer, and they can sort of even push through, attempts to sort of get rid of them. So, if you didn't want a healing or you didn't want some sort of changing your body, it would be very hard to get yourself to the point where it happened anyway. But after all this research I've done, I got to say, nothing's impossible. I sort of lost my my belief that anything's impossible.
I do get that, and the truth is, there's a difference between what you consciously believe and what you unconsciously believe. There certainly can be a difference. There was an interesting story that you shared about an experiment with soldiers, which has, everything that you wrote about just, opens up sort of the brain, if you will, to all kinds of new ways of thinking and healing and being. But tell us about the soldiers who were given a traditional painkiller, and they applied it, with a sound or a flavor.
Oh, yes. Well, this is one of the more inspiring things that I came across in my research. And this is, a lot of placebos, when we talk about placebos, we do tend to talk about tricking ourselves and playing, fooling yourself or lying to yourself. Well, there was a guy, Christopher Spivak. He's at Walter Reed, the medical facility in Bethesda. He's actually right across the street from where I got electrocuted. What's that?
I was saying that's Bethesda, Maryland, for people who don't know.
Yes, exactly. And he had this great idea. He saw some of this research. He saw Luana's work, actually, and said, what if I was to not try to trick people, but engage their subconscious and engage some of these placebo networks with, you know, with their permission. So what he did is, you know, he gets a lot of people who've had lost limbs in on the battlefield, and he deals with chronic pain. And chronic losing a limb is an incredible venue into experiencing chronic pain. A lot of people, you have phantom limb pain, which is where the limb that's gone that still hurts, or you'll have pain just on the remainder of the limb. I mean, there's a lot of pain that comes after an experience like that. And he was trying to see if he could limit some, not only the pain, but the amount of opioids that people had to take for the rest of their life. And so what he started doing was he started, every time someone would take a pill, he would give them some sort of stimulus, something that resonated with them. And so he'd have these long conversations with people. And so maybe it would be the caramel that your grandmother gave you when you were a kid. Or maybe it was the smell of eucalyptus trees outside your house. And he'd give you eucalyptus. Or maybe it was a type of music. And you would, and whenever you got that drug, you would get the stimulus. And again and again. And over time, what he did was he started taking away the drug and only applying the stimulus, only giving you the caramel, or only smelling the eucalyptus. And what he found is that in a lot of his patients, the brain would sort of recalibrate its perception of pain, and it would self-medicate, just like what happened with me in the electric chair. They would start to self-medicate, and a lot of theory around pain says that, well, pain is just a matter of like finding some sort of equilibrium anyway in the brain, and the brain seemed to be able to do that easier. And he's got patients from the Vietnam War who've been on opioids for 40 years, heavy, heavy opioids, and he's got guys coming back from the latest wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who are on almost none, you know, and they're almost pain-free or completely pain-free. And that's the power of the brain sort of figuring out where, you know, where the appropriate level of self-medication is. And it's a placebo effect. I mean, these are placebo effects that he's tapping into knowingly. And it's a very, very powerful, very interesting field of work that he's sort of stumbled on.
Oh, I mean, it's completely fascinating when you think about all the people, certainly, who are affected by the wars, but not only the wars outside of this country, but the many violent interactions that occur within the United States. And if there were a way to be able to resolve the pain that didn't include quote-unquote painkillers, my goodness. I mean, really.
Well, it's a very, very good point. And it seems to be that you need to get to it early. That's one of the things that he's found. And again, I think the science is going to really start answering these questions eventually. But he's found that there's an important step, which is getting to it before your brain gets too comfortable in the reality that it's sort of living in. But that's not to say that we won't figure out other ways to engage this with people who've had long-term chronic pain or something like that. I think it's a really inspiring area of research. I can't wait to see where it goes.
Well, I mean, it makes sense, at least as I'm thinking about it, it makes sense that getting to it early would make the process more effective. Let's talk a little bit more about medical doctors. You make a couple of points that a medical doctor who is not engaging in eye contact with their client, and who may then be saying, oh, don't worry, it'll all be fine. What's the likelihood that their client, their patient, is going to buy that?
Well, it's a really good point. And I often say, doctors, a lousy doctor is throwing away, 30% of their cure, depending on what they're working with. Again, there's these different diseases where you see this more clearly than in other ones, but I think it applies to everything. And I always go back to this one scientist I talked to who was studying the placebo effect, and she could not get people to have a placebo effect. So this is her job. She's studying it. Her whole life is built around this, and she can't get people to have them. And it was really very distressing for her, and she had this assistant who was doing great. She'd give people pills, and they'd feel better. And so she realized that she had to reevaluate the way that she was approaching the patients. And she had to change the way that she was interacting. In her case, she had to be more confident. She had to make eye contact. She had to, speak with authority and use sort of straightforward language. And once she did that, people had placebo responses, so she could do her work, and it was a big relief. And I think that a lot of doctors could benefit from that sort of self-evaluation, because for some, it's not about being more confident. It's about being more empathetic, about listening more, about the hand on the shoulder, or you know, the quiet words that good doctors do so well. You know, a good doctor is is amazing at this, and I've met some of them, and also some of the shamans and people I've met. They don't have active therapies. They only have their mannerisms and their bedside manner, and it can be a huge part of a cure.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Eric Vance and Suggestible You. Don't go away, folks. As you were talking, Eric, about the impact of a doctor's ability to attend, sort of emotionally, empathically attend to their client, I'm reminded of, at least in the beginning of the managed care part of our world, that doctors were, particularly medical doctors, were being required to see patients every 15 minutes, every 20 minutes. 20 minutes was a long visit. And a lot of times doctors would actually not look at the patient. They would write their notes while they were talking to the patient. And so I'm thinking now about how effective that approach would have been for the patients.
Well, it's a great point, and this is where the rubber meets the road. A lot of what I talk about in the book, you know, I have sections where I talk about things that are sort of in the future, and can we genetically tell who's a placebo responder, and you know, tapping into some of these things that Spivak was tapping into. But this is something we can do now, and this is something that any doctor across the country can engage now to take some of this research and really, you know, have a huge impact on their patients. And it's what you point out with this, you know, this 15 minutes sort of staring at the notes. This is a very common experience for a lot of people, and how they experience medicine. And I think very few people are getting the full benefit of their own brain chemistry in that experience. You know, that it's just, you're throwing away a big piece of potential therapies. And the people who understand this better than anyone else, in my experience, are people who are doctors who work with chronic pain, because they see this happen. I mean, I talked to a doctor who, he's one of the leading pain doctors in the country, and he said, look, I'm lucky if I can help 40% of my patients. You know, he said, you know, if I'm playing baseball, you know, I'll be making millions of dollars, but for a doctor, that's not a great number. And he's become very sensitive to the way in which you interact with the patient, because the chronic pain is so subject to placebos and to perception and to expectation, and your brain gets into these ruts of feeling pain that may or may not be existing in the body. And tapping into belief, into confidence, you know, even sending people back to church, you know, some doctors would say, I'll send someone back to church to deal with their chronic pain, can take a huge bite out of that. And if you're ignoring it, or you're pretending like, oh, this is, you know, this is not my job as a doctor, you are missing out, and you're really doing a disservice to your patients. And I also, you know, I talked to a doctor who was a trained doctor who was working in this sort of high speed, high fresher world of medicine, and she discovered homeopathy, and she actually switched to homeopathy and worked as a homeopath for a number of years, and then realized that homeopathy was just sort of relying on placebos and switched back. But in that time, she had an incredible opportunity to spend time with her patients. You know, she could spend an hour or two or, you know, multiple hours over multiple days with the patient, really understanding where they were coming from, where their pain was coming from, where their suffering was coming from. And I always say to people, like, if you ignore the power of the placebo, don't be surprised as a doctor, don't be surprised if your patients go somewhere else to get that. You know, there's, and the ideal situation is if we can combine placebo effects with active medication and with active therapies that have been proven by science. But people have always and will always go and get that somewhere else. Huh. And, you know, going back through history with the shamans on top of the mountains and different, you know, different ways that we've tapped into our belief, bloodletting, whatever you want, we do find that expectation wherever we can. And so it's an important part of who we are as humans.
Speaking of expectations, as we have been, I have to ask you about something that was in your book, which caused me to kind of raise an eyebrow, I confess. You said that in Mexico City has essentially a witchcraft public relations office. I misread that, right? That's not...
No, you read that right. So, first of all, Mexico City has a witchcraft market. It's a large market where people go to pick up their it's called brujería. It's witch doctoring sort of tools, and you can buy these sort of grim little burned baby doll things that are used for a number of different processes. You can get an iron sword. You can get whatever you need to do the magical practice that you do. And I went there actually to get cursed by a witch doctor for a long. You have to read the book, but it had to do with nocebos and my interest in my own fear. But to do that, you had to go through the PR office. And yes, the witch doctors had their own PR office, and they weren't terribly excited about their jobs, but they were there and wanted to know what we were going to be saying about the witch doctors.
Interesting. Okay, so I have to bring my eyebrow back down because it really is true. and you really were cursed by someone.
Yeah, it was. I interviewed a couple witch doctors. You know, I kind of was expecting the black magic part of this to be some sort of secret, illicit part of brujería, and to be like going to some back room somewhere where cauldrons are bubbling. It's not like that at all. Actually, it's very upfront. People will say, "Do you want black magic? Do you want white magic? Oh, you know, do you want me to curse someone?" You know, I have a woman who said, "I'll kill someone. You know, my curses. I'm dangerous." And so it was very upfront. So I had some great conversations with different witch doctors about these things. And I ended up picking one of them to put a curse on me for a week and a half, and just to see how it would affect my expectations. How would my week go if I knew that there was something, even if I didn't believe it? Some of these things, like I said, they're unconscious. They tap into their expectations. And I wanted to know if it would affect my health. And you'll have to read the book to find out what happens, but it definitely was an eventful week.
At the end of the day, I mean, clearly what you prove over and over and over again in so many different ways is that the power of expectation is pretty profound, and very human, and is a part of our lives whether we know it, believe it, or not.
Yeah, you know, and I have a couple of the chapters that we haven't really had time to talk about on you know, hypnosis, which is sort of the big, you know, overlooked part of this whole conversation just because of its sort of lousy reputation it's gotten, and false memories, which is sort of a secret area where a lot of scientists sort of wondered if there might be a connection to false memories and all this. But there's so many, and then at the end I have a lot of, you know, athletics and sex and all sorts of different ways that expectation creeps into our lives, and that belief creeps into our lives and can affect our bodies. And it's fair to say, I mean, even to the point of marketing, with, you know, what kind of wine do you drink and how is it labeled and will that wine taste better if it looks like something that should taste better? And these are things that happen to us every day, every moment of the day. And you can't get away from it. And I think a lot of people like to pretend that it doesn't, but it's nothing to be ashamed of. And it's nothing to sort of, call someone gullible or laugh at someone for rubbing a crystal over themselves. Like, this is who we are. And we all do it. There's some of us more than others, but we all do it. So you can't pretend like this isn't something that, that we all do. And it's an important part of what we do. Life wouldn't be much fun if we didn't have these things.
Let me ask you this. What is your thought about hypnosis? I mean, you're right. I mean, it's got, and you talk about clinical hypnosis versus performance hypnosis. And I would suggest that performance hypnosis really gives clinical hypnosis a very bad name. But that's my thought. What are your views on hypnosis?
Well, I think... Yes, performance. You're talking about stage hypnosis.
Right.
I always think about performance hypnosis in terms of athletics, but no, you're talking about stage hypnosis. This goes back, this actually goes back to the 1800s. And if you think about the movie, or you think about the story Dracula, think about the book. In the book, it's the heroes who use hypnosis in order to find the vampire. And then by the time it came out on the silver screen with Bela Lugosi, it was the vampire who was using hypnosis to control his weak-minded prey. And it was in that time between those two that hypnosis really got a bad rap. And it was partly because of these sort of stage hypnotists. It was a lot of fear at the time that innovation and all these different ideas, everything was changing, electricity and flying machines. And it just somewhere, and there were a lot of people who looked at hypnosis to tap into finding demons and the ghosts and all kinds of things, and it just got a bad rap. And when you look at it, it's a phenomenal, powerful technique. It has nothing to do with mind control, but it is a phenomenal technique for all sorts of treatments, especially chronic and pain or even acute pain. I saw some incredible things that, make placebos look like nothing when you have a talented hypnotist and someone who's responsive to that. A lot of potential that we really should be researching, but we're not, because I would argue because of this lousy reputation. And some of these scientists I talk to, dedicated, brilliant scientists, they tell people what they do for a living, and people laugh at them. I mean, hypnosis, well, that's a strange, are we going to be, looking for ghosts too? I mean, it seems like a very strange thing, but it's a very interesting, important field of study, and it's also something we do anyway during our lives. When you get fascinated by a cloud or a dripping water faucet or a fire, hypnosis is also a part of our daily lives. And so that's there's a lot more to say on this, but it is a fascinating, important tool, and we've kind of left it aside because it's not socially acceptable.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And for those folks who have not sort of thrown hypnosis off to the side, then they have a perspective about it that, you're going to look into something and instantly whatever your issue is going to be gone. So I would agree with you that there's certainly a lot that can be done with hypnosis, providing it someone who knows what they're doing and who's taking care. Tell us if...
Well, I actually didn't really answer your question. I'm really sorry about that. But I do say you shouldn't muddle with any of your own memories, and that's an important caveat. And also, like you said, I think when you see people on stage getting hypnotized, you get this impression that there's some sort of magical mind control, and most of those are stage tricks. And you were right in your previous what you said that, the stage hasn't done any favors for hypnosis. There's some fascinating people who do it, and they have some interesting things to say in the book. But you're right. Over the course of history, it's probably been a negative. Sorry.
That's okay. But let me just ask you again. You talked about performance hypnosis in terms of athletics. Do you see that as a positive or potentially harmful?
Well, the athletics and physical performance, I have a story coming out before too long in Outside Magazine along these lines. It's an interesting area in this, and not many people study it. There's a guy named Chris Beattie in Kent, UK, who really, I think, does the most interesting work along these lines. And you can tell people, You're, and this isn't exactly hypnosis, but with placebos, you can tell people you're giving them steroids, and you'll see these incredible increases, 20% increase in the amount of weight they can lift, and in fact, they're placebos. And belief, so there, the idea that's sort of floating around out there is perhaps there's some headroom. There's some room between what you can do and the maximum capacity your body can manage, and that placebos or hypnosis or even, you know, illegal drugs push you into that area of headroom, you know, and they push you to some place where that's beyond what you can currently do, but below the maximum you're capable of. And it's not surprising. I mean, athletes tap into hypnosis all the time. You know, you see them with their mantras before the game, or you see them, you know, doing whatever that thing is that gets them in that space of calm and focus. Well, that's a very light form of hypnosis, in my humble opinion. You know, having been an athlete.
Right.
Yeah, and any athlete will tell you that whatever their routine is, whatever their mantra is, that will get them into a place where they perform better than they thought they could perform, and that's that headroom that scientists are talking about and trying to understand. It's getting into that place between where you can normally perform and the most that you're capable of.
It really is fascinating work that you've been doing and that I know you will continue to do. Is there a website for Suggestible You?
There is, suggestibleyou.com, and it'll tell you about some of my upcoming trips. I'm going to be in Boston, and I'll be in Washington, D.C., and also Tulsa, and then I've got a few others coming up next year. But there's also ways to get the book, and I will keep updating it as my schedule changes. But, yeah, that's the place to go.
All right, suggestibleyou.com by Eric Vance. Eric, thank
Sorry,
you.
Suggestible You.
What did I say?
I heard susceptible.
Oh, isn't that an interesting slip?
It is. And we could spend a whole other hour talking about how that happened.
Indeed. But we're not going to. But thank you for the correction. Suggestible You by Eric Vance. Thank you again, Eric, so much for taking time out of your vacation to spend with us here on Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been so much fun.
Well, I am delighted. Now you can go back to your vacation.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. We've been treated to a really fascinating look at how we think, how we take in information, what we do with it, and how we can, in fact, begin to heal ourselves for Suggestible You. The placebo effect is inescapably real, and it shows us how much we have yet to understand about the connection between our minds and our bodies. In Suggestible You, Eric Vance has created a fascinating, engaging history of one of science's weirdest discoveries and takes us on a riveting journey through hypnosis, false memories, and the many other ways our minds can get manipulated. And this is from Carl Zimmer, who is the author of Parasite Rex, Inside the Bizarre World of Nature's Most Dangerous Creatures. And let me just share with you one more. This is from David Dobbs, who is the author of Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and The Meaning of Coral. And let me share with you another interview. This is from David Dobbs, who is the author of Reef Madness. David says he climbs cliffs until he's terrified. He lets scientists shock his fingers. He invites a curse upon his unborn child. Eric Vance, it seems, will do almost anything to show that we'll believe almost anything. He suffers, but in this remarkable book, we get a marvelous tour of humanity's dangerous but indispensable willingness to imagine. And folks, one's indispensable willingness to imagine is oftentimes what keeps us alive, what keeps us moving forward, what keeps us energized. I hope you have enjoyed today's edition of Mind Talk as we've talked about the placebo effect in so many different arenas. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service and is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's MYND TALK.org. And MindTalk is also available to you by downloading the MindTalk app from the iTunes Store. MindTalk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. But remember, MindTalk is available to you on demand 24/7. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela at MindTalk.org. That's Pamela at MindTalk.org. And remember, too, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.